Welcome back
to the Presidio Bitcoin Jam.
PBJ, what's going on?
Another Friday upon us.
Another Friday.
Another week where nothing happened interesting in the world, right?
Very boring. Very boring macro, very boring tech all around.
And I didn't even make it out here, I think, once this week. So my last thing was over the weekend when we were doing the hackathon.
Me too, actually. I had a lot going on this weekend.
Which is unfortunate. I love it when we get to make it.
There's a hackathon? Have we talked about that before?
So the hackathon, I think, was a huge success. I thought it'd be fun to just talk about like some of the projects that actually won, because if people haven't seen the live stream of the hackathon, I think I've been trying to represent some of the hackathon ideas to people, and I think I'm like not representing it as best as I could. So I was going to say, what if we kind of, I could hear from each of you your best effort at endorsing one or two of the projects that you saw at the hackathon.
Totally. Sure. And I would say before we even jump into the projects, I think it's maybe just like nice to set the stage a little bit. The hackathon itself, in my mind, was one of the most fun. I mean, I haven't gone to a ton of hackathons, but probably the most fun hackathon I've ever been to. It was just an incredible group. Like having, how many people do we have total? Like 40 or so, maybe 50 if you include all the sponsors and whatnot. Yep. Of like, some of the like most interesting people, many of whom I knew from Noster, but had never met, you know, IRL. I had a tremendous number of interesting conversations with Steven from Block. Like,
oh yeah.
That was a highlight, without even the project.
Big highlight.
But yeah, it was so awesome. It was like, we were chatting and all of a sudden it was like 11:30 on Friday night. I was like, wait, where'd the last hour and a half go? We're supposed to leave. Anyway, so the whole vibe of the thing, I would say, was just a massive success and super fun. I can't wait for the next one.
Yeah. I think we had about 30 builders.
Yeah.
16 teams formed. And I'd say the people that showed up, they are high quality.
Yeah.
That's what I was happy with. Like it was an open invite. Anyone could apply. So we looked at each person's applications and picked the best ones, but you still don't know. I mean, there are maybe like 8 or 10 people we already knew
right
at a time, but a lot of people were new to us. So that's exciting to see new faces. And they all belonged. So it was an exciting 24
hours. Which is tricky,
hours.
I think, if you're coming from like traditional tech, you expect to see like the certain resume with the schools and the companies they worked at and all this stuff. And in Bitcoin, it's not like that, right? Like in Bitcoin, it's like, how do you know if this person's like crazy genius?
Proof
like,
of work.
You know, mad scientist, which is like very frequently the case, or like, you know, I don't know, the opposite, off the rock, kind of crazy.
Borderline crazy.
But also, like, what's one thing we've talked a lot about on this show the last few months?
Diversification of risk.
Vibe coding, right?
And yeah.
I think that is a huge change. So we had, we definitely had a lot of developers show up. But we also had people who are not developers, people who had an idea, we had people show up who have a couple months of vibe coding experience. So they're actually like elite vibe coders.
Yeah, yeah.
We also had people show up that had never vibe coded and they don't know how to code. So we had the full range. And I think hackathons are going to be completely different moving forward.
Totally.
We'll get into talking about what the winning projects were, but just the fact that they were built and functional within 24 hours is amazing, I think.
Yeah.
So let's talk about those projects.
Yeah, let's talk about our favorites.
What were the...
To kick us off.
Max, you can start.
Okay. Well, so I guess, when we introduced Hackathon, there were two kind of broad categories we talked about. The vibe coding with Bitcoin payments using AI, that's awesome. And there were some really cool projects with that. Shout out, I forget, I'm terrible at names. You guys are going to have to help me with this. But there was a student, I believe, that came that, to your point, had never coded or vibe coded. And actually had a pretty cool, sort of financial literacy app built around teaching about Bitcoin. That was inspirational for me. And Billy Joe that flew out from South Korea also did like proof of walk, showing you that you could check in at different places. And those were inspirational just because it proved to me like, hey, anyone really can do this and there's no excuse anymore. If you have an idea, now is the time to build an app, integrate Bitcoin, Lightning payments. They all got them working with native payments. So that was super cool to see. Obviously, you guys are going to talk more about Matt's project as well. He was the elite vibe coder, but I love what he was trying to do and, establishing a norm of gratitude and bringing the Google reward system. Oh, that was super cool. So the vibe coding stuff was cool. For me, though, the thing that got me most excited was the sort of second category of projects, which is something we've been discussing on the show for a while, which is the idea of autonomous digital life. So this idea of, can you have AI agents that are able to profitably operate a business or whatever you want to call it? They're able to take some action in the world that yields more Bitcoin than they spent, and then potentially pay for their own life via GPUs. And so two projects really stuck out to me there. One, which won, of course, both the Audience Choice Award, which was awesome that we had the audience voting in first prize, was Lalu and Jason from Lightning Labs. And they had the Agentic Fuzzing League, which was a, I guess, what I would call a bot that can look for bugs in your code and continue to fix that, doing fuzz testing. And you have to pay using L402 every time you want to do it. That was really cool. And you know, of course, it's Lalu. So every time you see that dude walk in, you're like, yeah. Like, if I were competing, I'd be pretty sad about that. But he's next level. But I would say the project that got me probably most excited overall was the one that got second prize. Unstuck was the name of it. Unstuck mm-hmm. AI. And there was a couple of cool things about this project. The gist of the project is, and it also won the most sci-fi, and I think you'll understand why, that it sort of inverts the narrative of, you know, AIs working for humans and has humans working for AI. So this mm-hmm. is cool. It could also be freaking horrifying. But the way it works is the AI, let's say a model is trying to, you know, complete a task. And let's say you're asking it to, I don't know, run the mints, like we've talked about, run the cashew mints. And in the process of running the cashew mints, maybe it's registering a domain name, or maybe it's, you know, I don't know, launching a Cloudflare instance, whatever. And it runs into a CAPTCHA. And that CAPTCHA says, you know, prove to me you're not a bot. And of course, it's gotten good enough that the bot cannot prove it's not a bot. So what they had it do is quite genius. They took a screenshot of the CAPTCHA that needed to be completed and then posted it as a job on Nostr, which is open to anyone, and let people, I think, bid on how much they wanted to pay for it. You could also just do direct payments, obviously, in the future. And it's crazy. And then someone could literally solve the CAPTCHA, literally take a screenshot, and they had all that tooling built out, give it back to the AI. The AI pays them. Now the AI goes back to its original task and can get around the human piece. And so there's many, many applications for where that could go. But I don't know. I just thought it was a really creative idea, really clever, pretty terrifying. And the second thing that was cool for me about that was, as we were watching this presentation, because we had two rounds of judging. The first round of judging, we kind of had science fair. We went around and talked to people. They showed us the projects. And as we were watching, the guy was just like super impressive. And he was explaining all the stuff he built. And his partner made it. It was a designer, made it look really nice. But I'm like, wait, whoa, this dude is smart as fuck. Like, there's no way I don't know who this is. And then it just clicked on me, like his photo I recognized from Nostr. I'm like, oh, you're Dustin from Nostr. This guy I've been following closely from over years. Like, yes, I've been wanting to talk to you. I was like, me too.
Awesome.
And anyway, so that led to us then having a lunch the next day. And we've talked a lot about building decentralized intelligence on Nostr. That's its own rabbit hole. But that was a real treat for me.
Steven and I also had a similar moment where Steven, who you'd mentioned.
Not me.
Not you. Not Steve, but Steven.
At an inn.
We were like hanging. I think we were talking for like an hour. Yeah. And we were just like flowing with each other's brainstorming, just going back and forth. It was just like, you know, heaven. And then we're like, wait, check out like on Nostr, like follow me. And we look on Nostr and it turns out we're each already following each other. That's like, awesome. Oh, you're that Steve SI or whatever his name was on Nostr. Yeah. So it's fun to bump into a real life Nostr mutual.
Yeah.
Not even know it.
Yeah.
I also loved Unstuck AI for all the reasons you said. I don't have much more to add, but it's again, just incredible. Not only the concept, but what they built and got working in 24 hours, I found incredible. I'll talk a little bit about the third place winner, mm-hmm. which is Supersonic. A couple of guys, including Austin, who I know watches the show. He actually learned about the hackathon through the show.
That's cool.
and came and competed. And I thought what they built was like practical, useful, and they got it working. So Supersonic, it's a podcast player that they used AI to identify ads within the podcast and the time segments of those ads. And then if you want to skip those ads, you can like click the Supersonic button in their app, pay some Bitcoin, and then it would just auto skip those ads. So who doesn't want that value add?
And it only costs like, what, 10 Bitcoin or something?
Something like that. It was like, I think
a very small amount.
Charged 10 Bitcoin. Yes. with the Bitcoin symbol. But yeah, I thought that was, it was fully functional. Yeah. So pretty cool what they built. Fourth place, although I don't think that was disclosed, but the fourth place project was
Alpha.
We had seven judges, three of us and four other people who looked at all 16 projects. It was like a science fair style. I'm telling the audience this, obviously. You guys know this, but you know, we did a science fair style where the judges got a 3-minute presentation from each of the 16 projects. We all then independently, scored them across 3 criteria: how complex the project was, the execution quality of the project, and then sort of like swag factor and how on theme it was. Like, I mean, the theme was you got to incorporate Bitcoin somehow. So we did that. We then got down to the top 5. Those are the 5 that presented publicly through a live stream. And then the judges did another round of scoring. So the 4th place project was from Matt Belez, who's a friend of ours. And he's not a programmer, but he's been doing a lot of vibe coding, kind of like DK, the past few months. And just through DK's journey, and we talked about Miles Suter and Matt, just watching the 3 of you, I've seen how you've leveled up your skills with each project and using different tool chains. And so what Matt can build is pretty incredible without touching a line of code. The project there's 2 projects we should discuss. One is which is what he submitted and got judged on, and another he tried to get working, couldn't get it working, but I think would be interesting for us to talk about. The one that was judged, it was called Bitcoin High Fives, and it was the inspiration was sort of like give gratitude to people, but he previously worked at Google, so did David and I. One thing Google had was like peer bonus. Like if you wanted to give a bonus to a colleague or peer, it didn't need to be in your reporting chain. You could just be an individual contributor. It didn't matter who you were, just an employee. If you wanted to give a peer bonus to someone else, you could just do that. You could just go to the internal website and give a peer bonus. And I think it was material, like $100 or...
I think it was like $1,000 something.
Yeah. Or I don't know. I mean, it was like...
I don't know.
It was maybe. It was meaningful. It wasn't like, you know,
in early 2000s dollars.
It wasn't. Yeah. It wasn't like. It wasn't
just
like.
Clarify. You're having the company pay the peer bonus.
Yeah.
All you have to do is endorse the thing. You don't have to pay the thing.
Yes. But that was a thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was like.
You're probably right. I bet it was $100.
It was more meaningful than like a sticker, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So. And there's no real tool or mechanism to do that within your Bitcoin teammates, right? Bitcoin teammates, so you're not under one company. It's just Bitcoin colleagues around the world. We work with each other on different projects, or we admire people's work in Bitcoin. And that could be developers or people like influencers or thought leaders or however you're contributing to Bitcoin. So he built Bitcoin High Fives. I forget if it's singular or plural, but where you could... very simply enter someone's like Noster NPub or identity, type a little message about why you're giving them a shout out and what you're appreciative of. And then it just hard coded that 21,000 Bitcoin is what you sent to them.
Yeah.
So, which is about $21 or today, right?
I think it's like 22 or 23.
Yeah. Yeah. It might be $22 or $23 now, right? So more meaningful than like the default Noster clients are like 21 Bitcoin or 42 Bitcoin or something. So this was 1,000x more. So it's more substantial. But and then as part of that Noster post, it had the Bitcoin payment code in the post. So if other people saw it and wanted to also
pile in.
They just click a button and they could pay as well.
Yeah.
So he vibe coded this whole thing, didn't touch a line of code, got Bitcoin payments working in it. I thought it was like a really cool concept end to end. And it's also live. So yeah. I'm gonna start using it.
Do you know what is the URL? Does he have it deployed to something or it's on Replit or?
He does have it deployed.
It was something with the fives.
We'll have to include in the show notes or in tweet, we'll tweet it out what the URL is.
Iviv.es.
It looks nice. And one thing I want to pause and mention on this as well. So first of all, he did a great job in that. It was like, I like this idea of normalizing sending more value. We'll talk more about with the Noster network. Obviously, Noster is, actually I think this is very meaningful, just crossed 5 million payments, which makes it, at least by payment volume, the largest economy for Bitcoin in the world. But most of those payments...
That's 5 million unit payments?
5 million unique payments. Uh-huh. So zaps, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's cool, but most of those payments are like, very small, like 21 Bitcoin or 42 Bitcoin. Peer pressure, huh? Sats Bitcoin, whatever you want. But But anyways, but the point is, I really like this idea of normalizing, like, okay, this can be used for larger payments while at school. But the bigger thing I would love to hear about, and I don't know how much I want to, you know, go into detail on this now, but my understanding is that prior to this and vibe coding, you know, Matt was obviously very into Bitcoin, was not as much of a Nostr guy, but he built this whole thing around Nostr. So that was super cool for me to see.
Yeah.
And to be more explicit, he's been pretty skeptical and a critic of Nostr for 2 years now. I think he's largely viewed it through the lens of like a Twitter clone.
Social media.
And like, oh, there's no way it will overcome the network effects of Twitter. And I think we all agree with that. But now he looked at it through a developer lens. He really liked it as a developer. So he's still not, I don't think he's convinced yet of like the what the consumer success looks like, but at least, you know, you got it one step at a time, right? He really got one over from the developer experience.
That's cool.
And I think all things actually in technology end up getting really good at one thing and then they expand into adjacents. And so I don't think, I would agree with his kind of critique of Nostr as a social media tool primarily. Like, I don't think it leads with that in a sense. It's like, it's fine for us as a water cooler. But I think as a developer tool, it's unmatched.
I agree.
Right? Nobody can censor. You can actually pull down like, Steven's project pulled down every time somebody was talking about Bitcoin.
Is this anonymous?
Yeah, I'm not sure we want to be.
I don't know if he wants that to be known.
Yeah, maybe not.
Maybe a little too much alpha.
He worked.
Yeah. I didn't know that was that a bad thing or
it's all good.
I don't know if he.
I won't.
It's a cool project.
Point is, Nostr's permissionless. Point is, crazy.
She can pull
anonymous. Whatever.
Now everybody's going to want to know.
Okay, which case you're doxxed.
We're just helping you market it.
But the point being that you can develop anything you want and. If you have enough people developing enough different things on that, eventually it also becomes a place to talk, right? So in a sense, it doesn't have to lead with the place to talk. It can be lead with a place for infrastructure-y type projects, for developer projects.
Yeah. Yep.
Other thing on Matt's that I want to mention is, and I asked him as a follow-up at the panel, but he did both Nostr and Bitcoin. And he did it on Replit Agent where it was managing all the secrets for him.
Yeah.
So you don't have to really understand cryptography or public private keys for the most part. You can probably get away with mostly not understanding that even. And all you need is an idea and the ability to direct this machine, which is, I think it's like a huge deal because like understanding secret management and stuff is a little bit more of an advanced topic even than just like basic web development, right? And he was able to do all of that just with Replit and it was managing the secrets for him.
Yeah. And I asked Matt as a follow-up there at the hackathon. I haven't followed up with him since, but for videos or tutorials to kind of like explain it like we're five exactly how he did it.
Yeah.
I certainly hope he's going to do that. Also, Moritz from Albi was here, and which was awesome, by the way, having all of our other sponsors and, you know, tech partners, whatever you want to call it. But I think Roland on their team vibe coded a vibe coding platform so you can one shot Bitcoin Nostr stuff. He was showing that off to me as well. So anyway, I think we're reaching a point where, you know, we're getting better tools. The limiting factor right now, I think, is education. Also looking at our homie DK right now, who's our superstar vibe coder. But I really think that as we get some of that, like, just like, okay, Matt, show us exactly how you did that in like under an hour. And like, then I think anyone, I mean, like, I just think there's gonna be a Cambrian explosion. Like, seeing what he built, like,
just to reiterate, he built an application that integrated Nostr and Bitcoin payments.
And
he didn't touch a line of code. He's not a developer, and he did it within a 24-hour hackathon and built a completely working product.
It was, and you actually made this point, Steve. And I think it's a really good point where, you know, there were a lot of studs at this hackathon, a lot of like superstar studs, but even some of the developers that were maybe playing with more complex stuff struggled to finish projects and whatnot. Whereas the vibe coders got it all done. So it was almost kind of a weird, for the first moment, I thought, holy shit, like this might be like the new technology or energy source where if you don't use it, even if you are a good developer, you might get left behind.
I do feel like if you're a strong developer, but you aren't embracing new tools, a 24-hour hackathon can be a real challenge. And we did see some quality devs not even be able to produce what they had hoped.
Yeah.
Now, at the same time, a lot of vibe coded apps, if you really want to launch them, have them be secure and scale them, you still want real developers to build it out. But there's no doubt.
The agentic fuzzingly can also help you there.
Being able to express your ideas in a much more powerful way is upon us now.
Because if somebody expresses that idea and get just a little bit of traction, that'll attract like better people who want to actually like harden it in certain ways.
So I think
that's just like the natural state of the world is like the early things are messy and raw, but that's the sand you want to be digging in because you can play and find interesting things there. And then sort of you can professionalize it and like productize it and polish it over time.
And to be clear, I was sort of saying this tongue in cheek, but also not like, yes, like in this next, and there's always going to be a role, I think, for humans, at least the ideation phase in the short term, and maybe some of the polish phase. But I actually think the point of what Lalu was trying to build with the Agentic Fuzzing League really was, you know, I think, what was his quote that you tweeted about?
The S
in vibes
vibe coding stands for security.
Exactly. So like the use case for something like the
is no S in vibe coding.
For the Agentic Fuzzing League project was like, can you take these super cool prototypes that are hacky as hell and like, can you like make them production ready? So I think the AIs will do that too.
Just to wrap this up, a few shout outs. I want to give a shout out to Austin Krauss. This hackathon wouldn't have happened without him. And none of us had organized hackathon before, including Austin, but he led the charge. He was our leader of among like 10 volunteers.
Without
a lot of people came together to help.
Yes.
But he was our leader, did a great job, and you know, hundreds of details he got right. And it was really, I think both the sponsors, the partners, and all the participants had a great time. Also shout out to the sponsors too, Lightspark and Block, Fusat, HRF, and HiveMind.
We're
sponsors, and then also additional partners, Albi, like Moritz flew in from Europe to be here. We just had Lexi as well.
Yeah.
I think Philip is here all night long. We just had great support, and we're still collecting survey results to see. We asked participants which tools they used, but just from our own judging, we definitely saw lots of Goose usage, lots of Albi usage, lots of Spark usage, and I know Lexi got, they told me that they got a lot of great feedback from developers.
Oh,
so
good.
Yeah,
I think it was no doubt what we've talked about, what we suspected, which is like we've gone from it takes over a year for a developer to add Bitcoin payments to their app to like being able to do it in 24-hour hackathon. We proved that.
Yeah, it's
we
cool.
We proved that. And then we also thought that these tool providers would learn a lot, and I think they did.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that I would emphasize that I really liked about the hackathon was that people were not trying to necessarily take Bitcoin in new directions, but they were building applications that assume we have a native internet money.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like, I think, lost on some people. So some people are just casually explaining the hackathon to, and they're like, oh, Bitcoin, that sounds kind of limiting. Why would you require people to do Bitcoin? But it's like, we're not trying to encourage innovation of create a new money, create new features on top of your own new money. We're saying money's solved. Like, let's build new features that assume that the internet has money. And it's kind of like a bit of a mindset shift from, you know, crypto, Web3, kind of all that kind of narrative.
Yeah. And I think we all want to help Silicon Valley understand that. And so we're going to keep talking about it on this show.
Yep.
We're going to keep talking about it and doing events here at Presidio Bitcoin on that theme. But I think this hackathon like was a great initial proof point of that.
And two last things to say on that. One is for more Silicon Valley people or whatever that are thinking about this, I think one way that I would also frame what you're saying is, you know, nothing, this is, I guess, the Galt's Law, I believe, or whatever, like whole on theory, however you want to say it, like nothing in the universe, like if you try and design everything from the ground up, and this is, I think, the mistake a lot of the crypto people made, is it was too complex. We're going to shove everything, identity and payments and all this stuff from the top down. If you instead assume that you have lots of smaller pieces, each of which is independently working, and then you start lumping those together, that's how complexity emerges. And that's how you get beautiful new inventions. So we assume we already have the internet protocol stack. Amazing. Now we have, you know, value over internet protocol, Bitcoin. Now we have payments with Lightning and the things at the edge. Now we have identity with Nostr. And as you start to put these things together, confidential compute also, which reminds me, shout out to Fifth Place, which was Marks and Tony from Open Secret, who also, this one that was particularly exciting for me, had a project called Darwin, where they were trying to have two different AI bots fight each other for Bitcoin and sort of evolve naturally. Yeah. Between them and Steven, who I won't dox his other project like DK here, but also has some really interesting concepts around, you know, once you have all these different pieces I described, plus the confidential compute for secret storage. I think both of the Steven and the Open Secret guys are probably at the forefront of what evolution of digital life might look like. And that's very exciting too.
Yeah, actually the digital life kind of, as Steve called it, the spiel that you gave.
It was a spiel.
But it actually inspired a lot of people, because a lot of people kind of, it blew their minds. So if it kind of inspired them about what they wanted to work on at the hackathon. I think it was actually good in that it sort of delivered on that promise of like, imagine this future with us instead of just be rooted in reality of today.
If I can play my role as a protopian preacher, if you haven't heard the good word of Satoshi.
I just thought of something that we should let people know. Next week, we're doing a special edition of PBJ.
Yep.
So everyone who anticipates a Friday noon show, you're not going to get that next week. And it's because live from Las Vegas, the three of us will be in Vegas for the Bitcoin conference. And on Wednesday at 11:45 a.m. Pacific time, we'll do a special 30-minute edition of PBJ at the Bitcoin conference news desk. So this is the live news desk that they always have different personalities on and usually come on for like 5-7 minute segments. They were gracious enough to give us 30 minutes. We asked for 90, but 30 is like 6 times more than they give to others. So we're very appreciative of that. So we'll do a condensed version of PBJ. It'll be fun. It'll probably introduce this show to a lot more people. I think we're excited to do it.
Yeah.
And the other thing about Vegas is they have Steak and Shake in Vegas. So I'm going.
Making a pilgrimage.
How am I not going to Steak and Shake?
A friend of mine from Iowa, from long ago when I grew up, a childhood friend, texted me yesterday. He's not even a Bitcoiner, but he was at a Steak and Shake in Illinois.
Ooh.
We had him back there.
And they had, so he does not follow Bitcoin stuff. So he just didn't even know that they were supporting Bitcoin. He went into Steak and Shake and they had the terminal there, the point of sale that was marketing Bitcoin, took a picture and sent it to me because he knew I'd appreciate it.
That's awesome.
It's just a little anecdote of someone who's not in the Bitcoin world, them seeing it in daily life. And that goes a long ways in that
kind of normalizes it.
A lot of people still don't really, Bitcoin is magical internet money, and it goes up and down a lot in the price. Yeah. But is it just a digital rock? How do you use it? How do you get value out of it? And so, because most people, including us, you don't see it in your daily life.
Yeah.
And so it's an interesting touch point in your daily life.
I think for those of us on Noster and Stacker News, we definitely see it in our daily life. But who would have thought?
On Earth.
Like, yeah, exactly. In
physical world.
After all of our talk about the digital use cases, all it took was a burger and fries.
But there's one there, and we're on in the morning. So if you guys have time after the show, let's go.
Let's do it. Everyone else is talking about 110K Bitcoin, and
we just want to spend it.
We're talking about a burger.
Spend it before it gets any higher, please.
Yes, please. It's burning a hole in DK's pocket.
Spend and replace, right? That's the mantra.
Right. This week, I know we didn't have this plan, but I was also thinking about Google I.O. Did you guys watch any of the Google I.O. stuff?
I watched some of
Not much, but it looked like their film. Yeah. So I splurged to use the film because there's another AI filmmaking tool from like Hong Kong or Singapore, either from a Singaporean company. I tried
that. This isn't Kling? Kling AI?
I think it was something else. Okay. I tried that like a month ago.
Yeah.
I didn't try super hard, but like basic prompting didn't really get me very far. So then Google came out with Flow and VO3, as it called, their marketing of it just looked like mind-blowing.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I want to try that out. So there's not a trial. So I had to pay $450.
Seriously?
What? No.
No.
Yeah.
You got ripped.
Well,
it's $250. It's only $250.
Per month.
Oh, but you just blew through so many of them?
No. You have to sign up for you have to commit to 3 months.
Oh, okay.
And it was $150 per month. That's the discount.
The discount.
It's $250 or $300 after 3 months.
Right. Okay, got
but
it.
You, Yeah.
But so you have to
like
do a
$400 or $500 commitment.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Is it worth it?
No. I feel
what did you try to do?
I tried to create a film scene of someone rock climbing outdoors. I forget my exact prompt, but I gave it a lot of detail. Like, you know, I wanted a lot of suspense and drama and some death-defying.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I tried that prompt, and then it came back with a very poor quality video.
No. Oh, damn.
Didn't add any audio. So then I prompted asking it to add like dramatic music or whatever. Yeah. And everything that it didn't do what I wanted, I clarified, tried it again, and it was even worse. Then it showed indoor rock climbing.
Oh, no.
It literally looked like a video of me climbing indoors or something. It was just like so.
Nobody wants to watch that.
Well, it's not dramatic, suspenseful, or death-defying. Except me like dangling upside down or something. But
which was Steve running from the police on his bike.
Anyway, I'm sure I'm using it wrong. Yeah. But it would be nice if they gave a guide, like, here's these incredible videos that we marketed. Here are the prompts that led to that as a guide. And maybe they have that. I couldn't find it.
I would try prompting for that. Be like, hey, interview me to help me create a great
VO3. Which is kind
of what
Anthony and Mark suggested too. So I'll do it. Yeah. I've only spent like 20 minutes on it or something or not that much time. That's the next step. But I failed so far.
Yeah. But you've seen the demos at least.
Yeah,
the demos are
mind-blowing.
Amazing, because you've got like looks like Hollywood production video, and it's got audio. You've got sound effects of like the tiger walking through the snow. You've got comedians. Did you see the comedians?
No,
there's comedians telling jokes, like they just all fully generated. The jokes were generated. The comedian, the voice.
Yeah,
just up there on a mic. It's really great.
I look forward to figuring out how to.
Yeah.
The other thing that was interesting to me, it's interesting, even though I, in many ways, love technology, like I, in many ways, don't actually use it, but I love thinking about technology. And I saw the thing that also blew me away from Google is, I think they're winning on all of the important benchmarks. I think they're now number one and number two, or I'm not sure which benchmark this was, but on our singularity, a lot of people are claiming Google's now one, which seems a bit premature, but the biggest takeaway to me was that the number two model was their condensed version, sort of optimized around the edge. And not only that it was excellent, but that it was extremely cheap. And I think, as I think about where sort of the AI wars or the race or whatever you want to call this headed, I think there's always been a question of, does Google have, the leadership, the cojones, so to speak, to actually ship? We'll see. But what they do have is obviously incredible technical talent, but I think people are starting to see some of the advantages coming out with having their TPUs, their own chips they've been designing for over a decade. And really what I thought Apple was going to do, which is optimizing for on-device, which I'm sure they're doing with Android, if they can get these models to not only be, an order of magnitude better than others, but an order of magnitude cheaper, it seems like Google's in a really good spot.
So what's another AI player?
Oh, God.
Open AI. So a topic
Speaking of IO.
We've been wanting to talk about...
the opposite of the Angel Dimas.
We've been wanting to talk about WorldCoin. I might have been rebranded World, but let's just call it WorldCoin to be very clear.
Okay.
We've been wanting to talk about that for a while. Given the news of Sam Altman in OpenAI acquiring Johnny Ive's company. I mean, I didn't research a lot, but for $6 billion?
$6.5 billion.
A lot.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't even know the substance behind that other than Johnny
Talent
Ive is a famous person, but
big signing bonus.
Quick sidebar there. When Bill Belichick and Tom Brady won like six Super Bowls together, there's always the question of how much of it was Tom Brady and how much of it was the genius coach, right? Well, then the next year, Tom Brady went to the Buccaneers and won the Super Bowl.
We got an answer.
There's no question Tom Brady is the GOAT. And I'm not even like a Tom Brady or Patriots fan, but like, I don't see how you can question that. Yeah. Belichick, did he have a winning season after that? I don't know. So maybe at North Carolina he'll win. But anyhow. But
he woke up and chose violence.
So there's many angles we can go with the Belichick story, including his new girlfriend. But anyway, let's stay on topic. do you not know about this?
No, what's the deal?
He's dating like a 22-year-old. He's like in his 70s, right? And he's dating a 20-year-old girl.
Anyway, Belichick.
That's for another show.
Yeah.
But I liken the Belichick-Brady to like Steve Jobs, Johnny Ive, like at Apple. And so I guess this will be an opportunity. I mean, has Johnny Ive done, has he done anything interesting since Apple? I don't know. I literally don't know. So I just, but maybe not. So like this maybe is an opportunity to see like, what did he do at the startup? What's he going to do paired up with OpenAI and with Sam Altman? It appears they've built some kind of AI pin, like from the movie Her. Uh-huh. It's called Her, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's an earbud though, or if it's a device that you pin to your clothes, or you place on a desk. I'm not sure what this product is. Did you guys see that at all?
I think it's not announced. I think it's just a vague meeting of the minds, not like a here's kind of what the product is.
TBD.
So, I mean, the whole wearable space is a whole other area we can get into sometime.
Yeah. And, do you have any opinions on that?
Well, I spent 4 years of my career working on Google Glass, right? So in wearables, so have a lot of thoughts there. Definitely can speak to what
doesn't work.
What doesn't work. I'm an expert at what does not work.
Did you hear Sergey was on, they did a special interview with Sergey from Miami. I think the All In folks had him in Miami or something. And he was talking about Glass and kind of the rebirth or recoming of what that could be. Yeah.
Actually, a really funny story at the hackathon this past weekend. One of the teams pulled out a photo of them. They bought Google Glass over 10 years ago, and they still have that photo.
Didn't you guys have like Tom Cruise jumping out of a plane or something?
we did. Yeah. Some episode we'll have to go through a lot of my Google Glass and Sergey stories and stuff. But one of them, yes, someone jumped out of a plane, landed on a high rise in San Francisco. They landed on the Moscone Center, then did some bike tricks on the roof, and then scaled down the wall, and then ran onto the stage of Google I.O. It all worked.
Right? The video's still on YouTube, I bet.
Yeah, and then there's a live stream of the whole thing.
Right.
The number of permits required to do that was insane. It wasn't just FAA. It was like multiple agencies within San Francisco, because no one had ever skydived over San Francisco, the city, before.
Mention the aircraft. Was it aircraft carrier or whatever that you, was it part of the launch?
we purchased barges. We'll have to, go into that sometime. There's a lot of good stories there, but anyway, I brought that up just because for any kind of wearable, I definitely have hot takes on it, but it's more, if I knew the formula for what's going to be successful, well, maybe I would have been successful in the past, or I'd have some great vision, but I definitely know what things I'm really skeptical about. So I remain bullish on something that, goes in your ear or somehow on your head or face, really hard to solve. And 15 years after Glass, no one's done it yet. And so it might take another 15 or 20 years. I don't know. But something that's not near your face will be challenging, just from how do you get output out of audio. So like the movie Her, and like with a basically like AirPods on steroids, that I think has promise. But an AI pin that like that Humane one, never, I was always skeptical about, because it's like, pinned here on your belt or whatever.
Well, I thought actually, so I didn't listen to that one, but I listened to an interview with both Sergey and Dimas, who obviously is DeepMind and now I would argue is effectively the CEO of Google. I had a lot of takeaways from that interview. One is just like, man, I really like that guy. Like in the race for superhuman intelligence, like I really hope he wins.
It's easy to hope that he does.
Oh man, could one of the good guys actually win? Yeah. Like that would be really awesome for the world.
But, did you see the documentary drama?
I did. Yeah. It was phenomenal. And again, I don't know him, so like maybe behind closed doors he's not, but whatever. But like it seems like he's coming out.
He's cultivating this aura of like,
there's
no hey,
weird.
I'm better than you.
Yeah, I'm here
like,
to like.
Let's talk about weird stuff.
But before we talk weird stuff, the important point he made that I thought was great on your wearable piece was his point. Sergey had a very similar reaction to you of like, this Glass was horrible, this and that. But Dimas, his whole point was, in addition to the hardware getting better, something like Glass, what it needs to work is the killer app, which is the assistant. his whole point was it will never work. Wearables will not work until you have basically superhuman intelligence that helps you 24/7. Once you have that, it will work. And I actually found that pretty compelling. Yes, the hardware, the form factor, all that needs to get figured out as well. But I think in order for me, at least, to even consider putting on some new hardware device, like it would have to be a radical, like, hey, I'm talking with my assistant that in real time is helping me navigate my life. That's what we need.
And that's certain. I mean, the technology today with LLMs compared to 2011, it's night and day. Like in 2011, Google Glass, we had voice control. So you could tell it, take a picture, you could do searches. It was good at understanding what you're saying, but it had to be a proper grammar and structure. And then you gave it a specific command and you got a specific result. So it could do that. But now it's just like, you can just be very naturally speak to a computer and then it can give you, obviously much better results. So anyway, but let's talk about the stuff that maybe concerns us a little bit. So, yes, there's going to continue to be developments around wearable computers and computers that are like always listening and tracking what you're doing. There's also, development of AI. And like one thing that OpenAI, well, it's a separate entity, but WorldCoin that Sam Altman's involved with, they launched a new token a few years ago, a new cryptocurrency token. So that, it's a pre-mine.
Currency.
It was a pre-mine token. So, like out of the gate, just that alone, the three of us don't like it.
Do we even know, is it on Ethereum or is it its own blockchain or? Yeah.
I don't think it matters.
I don't know. I actually would be curious.
It's on a MySQL database.
It doesn't matter. Pre-mine token, that's for me, the litmus test, I think for you guys. Our audience that are Bitcoiners, it's their litmus test too. Our audience who is Silicon Valley people, maybe they don't quite know why we feel that way, but that alone is.
I think, could you represent if you were coming from a different perspective or not as tuned into this, and you said why are you the one to decide what anybody should be allowed to work on? Let creative, let 1,000 flowers bloom. Let creative people create different things. Why not?
Well, I do have the attitude that people can work on what they want to work on. So people can create new tokens do pre-mine tokens. And I don't think there needs to be a police to stop them. I'm not going to stop them. But I would advise no one investing in that or using that. I think, but it also depends on the application. So, because another framing of that question from someone from Silicon Valley in particular would be isn't this just the new form of equity?
Mm-hmm.
And don't we need to fund development or something? Because you Bitcoiners are always talking about begging and pleading for donations to open source projects. Well, why don't we just fund this the way we know how to?
Yeah.
Which is investors fund a new idea. They get equity, or in this case, they get tokens that can increase in value. That framing, that resonates with me. And I suspect us, we're all investors. We're on cap tables. Yeah. We believe in that. But it's very different. And for me, crosses an ethical line. Because one difference here is we've seen time and time again with token projects that you can exit and get liquidity and exit your initial position, not even before product market fit has been achieved or any value creation, but even before a product's been built. There's been many tokens that literally you just dump it on retail and it's just a gambling casino, and there doesn't even need to be any software behind it, let alone actual societal value created. So that is, it's produced incredible returns for venture capitalists and the founders. But how much value to society compared to the value that Google's brought to society, or Facebook or Uber, or name any company. So that's why I have an issue with it.
I would go, yes, agree on all of that. And by the way, most of these sort of venture capitalists that got into the crypto game, it's a very sad and slippery moral slope to watch, because they effectively become hedge funds, not venture capital funds. To me, venture capital in the lockup, you wait till you get some liquidity event, that's a feature, not a bug. Once you start being able to get liquidity from day one, to your point, and yes, there obviously are illiquid markets, and you can do that a little bit, take stuff off the table, but it's not like a public exchange, right? And that obviously creates perverse incentives where all of a sudden it's hey man, what if we just have the right marketing spiel? This thing 10x is fuck it, we're out. And I think that's what we've seen from, I would say, basically all of the funds that have participated in this. But that's a separate story. I would take it a step further and say, you know, in preparation for some of our discussions today and in the future about the future of Bitcoin, the world on a Bitcoin standard, I've been looking at some books that that I've been meaning to read for a while. One of them, I want to give a shout out to Alan Farrington and his co-author on Bitcoin is Venice. Fabulous book. Absolutely fabulous. Like a couple of the chapters I've read. And one of the points that that Alan raises in that book, and actually Ben Ark raised in a conversation I have with him as well, is that as you think about, you know, where we're headed with open protocols, the political economy of the world with open protocols like Bitcoin, Lightning Network, and Noster, you know, there are obviously a lot of the sort of like ANCAP, super pro-free markets people. And like, I think all of us are pro-free markets to a point. But there's also this point, you know, where it's not just that. It's actually something brand new. It's, in a way, Ben Ark used to go by BTC Socialist, which is a sort of incendiary and like firebrand name. Mm. But I think the point he's trying to get at is it's also looking at, you know, in addition to free markets, the idea of what I would call stateless socialism, which is the idea of essentially having public goods without having a mega state to control the public goods. And so what I would argue that stuff like Bitcoin and Noster are, I think Alan had a different name, which I forget the exact terminology used, but to make it simple, something closer to a public good, right? And so I would argue the internet is something like a public good and will increasingly hopefully be funded with Bitcoin incentives. Bitcoin, I would argue, the network itself, the security of that network, the hard cap and the limit, not the individual UTXOs, that's private property, but the network itself is a public good. I would say argue the same with Noster. And I think the argument that people like Alan and Ben and myself, frankly, in the past have made is that if you, you know, free markets are beautiful when competition is allowed to thrive, but not eat the entire system and capture it. If anything gets too big to capture the entire system and the commons essentially is overrun, then the system stops working. I would argue that's what we have in today's modern world. Like the books like Bitcoin is Venice are very deep. And I would encourage anyone that's really intellectually curious about why Bitcoiners are so, morally fired up about Bitcoin, like read that. I mean, it kind of, to put it simply, if you think about what's happened since 1971, WTF happened in 1971.com, shout out, or even the financial crisis, right? Like when our current system is called capitalism or free markets, but it's not, it's really socialism, but it's socialism for the very, very, politically connected or wealthy, the wealthy that are wealthy through political connection. And by that, what I mean is the mantra is privatize the gains, socialize the losses. So if I'm a bank and I write a whole bunch of risky loans, like happened to in 2008, 2009, great. I'm making it rain. The executives get paid. The shareholders get paid. It's fucking awesome. Oh shit. Those loans we wrote were actually really bad. Who would have thought the stripper in Miami maybe shouldn't be buying five houses with $100,000 or, you know, $50,000 a year in tips or whatever. Now what? Well, we're all too big to fail. We're gonna get bailed out. Well, when we get bailed out and the money gets printed, who ends up holding the bag? Grandmas. Normal people, the tax holder or the taxpayer, same people that are getting dumped on by the crypto VCs as well. And so anyways, that there's a much longer sort of moral and philosophical discussion around this. But what I increasingly see things like Bitcoin and Noster as are these public goods where private enterprise and free markets can thrive. But as Ben explained in our podcast that we did a year or two ago, if they get too big and try and like completely capture the whole system, it's going to be like just what happened in the block size wars or whatever. Bitcoin is going to come and, as Ben says, give you the invisible bitch slap from Adam Smith. And so anyways, I think that's a longer discussion, but I think this idea that you need public goods that are not governed by the state, but that are governed by code, by consensus, by, you know, the community itself are very valuable. And money is one of those, and it's different than equity.
So with WorldCoin, one concern is pre-mined token, but another is...
biometrics.
Privacy concern. And the idea, my understanding, the idea behind WorldCoin is to become a member. Basically, you have to have your eyeball scanned by an official orb, WorldCoin orb.
Yeah.
And then an incentive to do that is that you get an airdrop of WorldCoin tokens.
Right.
So you get you get paid to scan your eyeball. I also believe they have like WorldCoin orb like advocates or champions who go around and they get paid even more airdrop WorldCoin to convince other people to scan their eyeball. So they have like an army of orb people around the world, and they've gone to countries like in Africa and Asia and all over the world. And I believe they're in San Francisco now trying to get, you know, scan people's eyeballs. I think they've explained a design where they try to retain privacy, but I don't know. I haven't like scrutinized it, and I don't know. My instincts are that Apple does a lot better job than probably this startup at having a very secure private system. But
Apple has a lot to lose in brand and reputation.
Yeah. So that concerns me. But I mean, but yeah. what are they trying to do? I mean, the problem they're trying to solve is that how to prove your identity, that you're a human and not an AI. And so by scanning your eyeball, they use that information to tie that to an identity that you can then use within OpenAI and I guess the internet to prove that, you know, this is you, David King, and not a bot.
But why does it matter, though? Yeah. I think the question of like, is it a human or not, like, sounds good on the surface. Like, yeah, I want to know that I'm interacting with the humans. But like, if many of the people that you're interacting with on the internet are humans today, and in the future you end up mixing in a bunch of bots, but you never actually are going to meet these people, shake hands, et cetera. Just like people you talk to and share information with or gather. Like, what is so special about it being a single unique individual human versus a bot or a group of 10 humans? Like, I think the opening question is almost like flawed.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think we should discuss
attractive
alternatives, but I think there's more to it than just that. I think the other thing they're going to try and do for sure is UBI with this. So in addition to just proving I'm a human for the internet, they're literally going to be like, okay, there's 8 billion humans or whatever, however many they can sign up in their ecosystem. You should use us in OpenAI's ecosystem because we give you a cut of whatever our revenue is or something like that. I think that's why they're doing it.
But even the concept, though, of like we're going to mediate the distribution of this is still like a person has to decide, I'm scanning your orb. These are how many orbs we're scanning. This is how much the data is worth. This is how many coins we're going to issue. And they have to kind of keep adjusting that as the system grows. So it's not like a set of rules. Like the thing we love about Bitcoin is just a set of rules just goes, right? These are not a set of rules. These are like people deciding. So in a sense, we're sort of adopting a new politic.
That's I mean, look at what's trying to happen here. Like I think if you purely analyze this from an economic lens, it's not going to make as much sense. If you analyze this from, is someone trying to, I don't know, become the emperor of some form? Like, this would be a way to do it.
Of world coin. It's
like of the world.
Ambition,
yeah.
Is the world, right?
It's a very ambitious project and ambitious around power, I would say.
Yeah.
So I think there's no doubt that is not a world that anyone should want and will be very bad for humans.
Yeah.
So now it could certainly be the case that it just fails. It's just yet another like VC funded startup that goes nowhere and fails. I think that's the likely outcome. However, getting back to your question, David, I don't have a good answer either. I'm curious, and maybe someone listening can like comment to give us ideas about where does it matter about distinguishing between a human, like proof of a human versus AI. If somehow that proves very important, and then people around the world do adopt this because it's the only solution available to get past this, that would be scary. So I think in future shows, or like what we should be thinking about is like, one, where is it actually needed? And then if it is, like, what are alternative solutions that aren't as scary as having like a single person or company in charge of so much stuff?
But I think the question of like, is this a human on the other end of this internet discussion or chat or whatever you want to use it for, I don't think that's broadly that important. But I do think knowing when I'm talking to Steve or when I'm talking to Max that I'm talking to Steve and I'm talking to Max, I think that is important. But I don't need reference that you're a human. I can validate that, verify that myself in the flesh here. And then I could use, we could use public private key cryptography to ensure that we're talking to the people.
We already
that we're
do this with Signal, right? Yeah. So Signal, yeah. We can exchange information in person. It shows a specific code that is just between the two of us,
yeah.
That uses information from each of our phones to create a unique string, and we can look and compare, and yeah. Then we know all future communication, as long as it's coming from that code, we know it's from each other.
And to abstract this out a layer deeper, because this is something that we've talked about on our show before. I know we've talked about on Noster News, is, and this is one of the reasons I'm so, and always have been so bullish on Nostr, is Nostr is just, it's a public-private key identity system, similar to Signal, but you can use it anywhere on the web. And I would say it's less important. I agree. Like, I wouldn't frame it as, is this human or not? But what I would frame it as is authenticity, right? So to your point with these Google videos, and like, by the way, I mean, I'm increasingly at the point where it's like, it's time to kind of like retreat from the web for a year or so, because shit's going to get too crazy, right? And so—
Just a year? Like, you think it's going to be fixed a year from now?
Well, I mean, hopefully if the Nostr community has something to do with it, I certainly hope so. But, you know, forget human or not. If I see a video and I, you know, see this is DK talking, or I see this is Jack Dorsey talking or whatever, now that the models have gotten so good that you can literally just make up literally anything, like the golden age of deepfakes was already upon us, and man, it just went on steroids, and it's going to get way worse in 6 months and then way worse in 12 months. Yeah. And so forget human or not, like what WorldCoin reports to be solving is a really real problem, which is, I don't know what to believe on the internet anymore. There is no trust without an identity system. There's two approaches you can take to solve this problem. Approach number one is have a centralized entity control the identity. That's what we've done in the past with either governments or corporations. That's what we have with OAuth and servers from Google and Facebook and Twitter and whatever. That's one path. And they're trying to do it from a private company. Now, obviously, the problem is whenever one administrator, one company, one government, whatever, administers that whole identity, I'm sure they'll have a consortium and this and that. But like, you know, if one entity is controlling it, there always remains tremendous opportunity for abuse. That's the whole point of things like Bitcoin, right? Is anything that's done in secret where there's a centralized ruler you have to trust, there's a potential for abuse. The alternative is to have it grounds up. And this is what I love so much about Nostr. And the reason I'm so bullish on it is this concept, one, that any note you sign or any note you post, you have to sign. As long as I know Steve's key, his pub key, and I see it signed with his private key, assuming Steve didn't lose that key, and we'll eventually figure out solutions to that with rekeying and stuff like that, then that's the only thing I'm going to believe on the internet other than seeing him IRL. Similarly, there's this adjacent concept of the web of trust, which has gotten me so excited about Nostr. And this comes from the early cypherpunk days with PGP keys. PGP keys was trying to do the exact same thing as Nostr in a sense, but it was too complex. And so I think, you know, maybe at max 50,000 people or something have ever used it over 20 plus years. Nostr, we know, you know, we have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people that have at least gotten a Nostr key for the first time in their life. And so we're already very sort of ahead of that curve. But the point is, you can have these emergent and contextual webs of trust where you say, hey, when it comes to, you know, knowing what's going on with Google releases, well, if I see that DK and Steve in particular liked or zapped a post or follow someone, I'm going to weight that much more heavily because I know these guys were at Google and knew something about that. If I see, I don't know, like, I don't know, Austin was telling me about Italian food or something. And like, I'm like, okay, Austin probably has good taste in Italian food. And I see he rated a restaurant. I'm going to give that additional weight. But the point is, your identity is not one thing and fixed and controlled. It's contextual. It's ground, bottoms up and decentralized. And that's the vision of the world I want to see.
So, and anything else on where, I mean, I think future shows will talk a little bit more about identity and AI and WorldCoin, but anything else we know about now that are concerned or
I mean,
thoughts?
I worry about, you know, this, I think it's a sort of a famous quote. Was it one of the Berkshire guys, I don't know, Munger or whatever, where he said, in the short term, the stock market is a voting machine, in the long term, it's a weighing machine. Hmm. Which kind of, do you know that quote? Have you heard of it?
Yeah, I don't know.
Which I think, I always take that to mean kind of like, in the short term, it's really about, in a sense, what do people believe? And in the long term, it's what is true. And the thing that I feel like all of tech, to some extent, yeah, when I got excited about tech initially, it was like, because you can build things, you make things, and bring something from your head into reality. And that was what's exciting about it. But we've gotten so far down, like, the financialization of everything. You know, big long-term dreams that need a lot of support to be able to have, you know, to be able to be built, that like a lot of tech has become more like a social consensus building machine instead of a weighing machine, right? It's more of like a voting machine. And I feel like WorldCoin is like kind of a very strong example of, like, people say, oh, like, wouldn't it be great if we knew what was a human versus what was a machine? Yeah, on the surface, that sounds good. So it's easy to sort of trick people into buying into a system because it has a really simple, on the surface, attractive message. But if you start to peel back a few layers, you start to see all of the problems with it. Like, well, I'm contributing my biometrics to some dystopian overlord who gets to control the flow of funds and stuff. So I think like there's a broad story here of like, you know, how to think better about these simple messages you get. And even on the, you know, the Johnny Ive thing, I think a little bit, it's like, it's a, on the surface, that sounds like, oh, got, you know, great collaborator, inventor of the iPhone or whatever you call it. But like the thing that makes the Apple system work has so little to do with that today. It's like the supply chain and the manufacturing and distribution and the capital and
the trust and brand.
The trust and brand. And actually, you know, to bring it back to the Google Glass stuff, it's like having connectivity to your phone was a huge problem for Google Glass. And so I don't think it's just bring a few people together and make the magic. I think there's like, think about the system behind it and who's building that system and are you going to be able to compete at that system? So sorry, I'm a little bit off on a few different topics here, but I think on the WorldCoin stuff, I'm concerned that it's a lot of very simple, attractive messages where when you get like one layer beyond it, you're like, whoa, this is just, you know, this is a pitfall of dystopia that we're going into. And so I would like to see a world where we don't adopt those. I would never touch one of those machines. And I think like it's mostly just a lie being told.
This is coming from the person who has their, like a code on their palm.
Yeah.
Didn't he share that with us a couple weeks ago?
Yeah. And I was thinking about that because it's like,
that's also pretty scary.
I think that's a scary future, but I also think that it doesn't purport to be anything else. It's like, I do intend to use this card with this service provider and they're simplifying my payment experience. So like, yes, it can get dystopian.
Did you need to buy a new cryptocurrency token in order to use this service?
I didn't.
Yeah.
So that's and one, I walked out of there with the food that I intended to eat, which I then ate. Like it worked, you know, like there was an exchange of value. Whereas this thing is kind of like, hey, get some of my cryptocurrency token that I just made up and I'm going to issue more. It's like, okay, we've got, you know, the federal U.S. Treasuries and the Federal Reserve all over.
I think the other concern about this is like, if someone were just doing this out of the blue, even if it were a successful entrepreneur, I would kind of agree with your take. It's just going to fail. Like there's no, but like, this is a little different because if OpenAI wins the AI race, which is, I mean, they're one of like four contenders, five contenders max. I mean, this is going to be a very valuable service. And like, a lot of people are already using OpenAI. How many do they have? Several hundred million. So it's not like they're starting from zero and they've got many of the most powerful backers in the world. And I would just say it would be a little bit concerning if they win the race and the only way to use it becomes a WorldCoin. Like, okay, that's not a great outcome. Well, I don't think that's the most likely. But
I think it's nice that we've got, you know, DeepSeek and open source, XAI, got Llama and all kinds of alternatives that are going to not be controlled or that are going to create, you know, a check on any kind of controlled central systems.
Kraken?
All right.
Our next topic.
Yeah.
What did Kraken announce this week? X-Stocks, is that what it's called?
That's the name of the service within Kraken, yeah.
So it is, I only know the high level, but I think the whole topic is interesting. The high level, Kraken introduced a new service where people around the globe can get access to equities like Tesla stock and Google stock that's been tokenized on a Solana platform. They partnered with some company. I forget the name of it.
It's called Bakkt, I think.
Okay, yeah.
But not the other Bakkt.
I mean, I think Uniswap has had trading of stocks. You know, people have created it on that deck.
And didn't Abra do something like this?
Yeah, actually.
A while back?
Yeah, Abra was the original.
Like several years ago, I thought.
Well, yeah. We should talk more about that because I think they actually had the correct approach, but too early. But
a few things that I think would be interesting to discuss. One, I assume they got SEC approval for this.
I assume they didn't. It's not, you can't it's do this in the US.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, they've just been, you might be right. I only said that because they are regulated by the SEC. Company. They've been sued numerous times by the SEC. So they're clearly like, they interact with the SEC and has some sensitivity there. So obviously there's a new administration now and a new head of the SEC, very different environment. But just interesting that they took such a bold move to launch this product. So I don't know. Well, that's one thing. And then two is just like, is this good or bad for the world? For who is it good for? Who's it bad for? What are the pros and cons?
So two things I want to address is who it serves and then the actual technology they're using to serve. Because I think those are two different and both important points. For whom it serves, I definitely saw firsthand there's real demand for this. So when I lived in Mexico, all of my friends there, unless they were like super wealthy and had like accounts in Miami or something, like let's say 90% did not have access to US equities.
Mm-hmm.
All of my friends wanted to buy, interestingly, Tesla. And none of them, or Apple or Google, but mostly Tesla. And none of them were able to buy a Tesla. And it's a real shame because if they had bought Tesla, they would have over 10x. And so it's just super unfair, right? That you can't access the deepest, most interesting, innovative capital market in the world just because you got born in the wrong place. So I think the problem it's solving for most of the world, that's a real problem. It's real. I love that. I think it's awesome. It's fair.
Yeah.
In terms of doing it on Solana, I mean, I get Solana is faster and it's got some adoption today. To me, I think it's interesting. I always see all the other blockchains as kind of like testnets. I guess it's cool in the sense that it will prove if there's demand, if they can do it legally or not, whatever. But I think in the long run, the thing I'm much more interested in with all of these, let's say, other instruments besides Bitcoin is who's going to be able to bring it in a way that's interoperable with Bitcoin. This is the same with stable coins, right? So we've talked about, are we going to have stable coins on top of Bitcoin, the Lightning Network, something like Taproot assets? Is it going to be through Spark? Is it going to be through building Lightning Network bridges, which I still think is a huge opportunity between the Bitcoin network and the Solana network, whatever. There's all these ways that that can happen, but I think this product becomes much more interesting if you can tap Bitcoin liquidity, if you can use the Lightning Network for instant final settlement. To your point, Abra, back in 2018, I was looking very closely at their product, and I think Bill Barheit was he was just too early and way ahead of his time. Shout out your homie Sunil. I know he had some part to play this as well. But basically, what they were creating was contracts for difference on top of Bitcoin. So I think it was like a 2 of 3 multisig where you would have Bitcoin collateral and use that to create sort of in the same way that Galois does today, synthetic dollars with like long simultaneous long short positions. They would do that with stocks. I thought it was a great idea and it was interoperable with the Bitcoin network pre Lightning. So it missed out on that. Again, they were too early. But I think that while the Solana thing is cool, I think the big winner in this world, whether it's Taproot assets or Spark or whoever, is going to be the one that figures out what Abra was trying to do, which is how does this interact directly with all of the capital liquidity effects and some final settlement of Bitcoin Lightning.
And why, I mean, as long as Bitcoin's money, why does it have to be technically connected to it in some way?
Well, I think if you want to get the most sort of liquidity around it, yes. I mean, right now, right, like how do you get in and out of Solana and Bitcoin? Well, you need a centralized exchange. That's fine. And like Kraken, you know, whatever can serve you. But if you wanted to do that and let it go fully emergent, decentralized, you need a way to bridge Solana and Bitcoin directly. One way to do that would be through a Lightning Network bridge between them, which I think is an interesting concept. Another way would just be to bring that tokenized asset to Bitcoin.
Do you mean the reason they need to be connected is because you're buying Tesla stock with Bitcoin?
Yeah.
Okay.
And because underneath it, like if you did it the way that Abra was trying to do it, you still get access to all of that Bitcoin liquidity for the same reason that I think stable coins are going to be much more powerful and move a lot more on the Bitcoin network than they do in these. Because again, to me, Bitcoin, everything that comes on top of it is the internet of money. Solana, Ethereum, all these other sides or whatever they are, blockchains are intranets. And intranets are limited in their scope. If you connect to the internet, you have far wider reach.
But I guess like, I mean, I have some concerns. I don't know a ton about the details of how it's actually built, but I have a bunch of questions about that.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, I'd rather understand more about what is the hypothesis for how it's intended to work? Because I feel like if you can spend money somewhere, you could spend Bitcoin there. You can find some way to convert it into whatever format is needed or something, right?
Well, if it's like, a centralized, yeah, or let's walk through.
Yeah.
Let's say I'm a Mexican citizen, upper middle class. I want to buy some Tesla stock. I've never been able to do that before. So now I use some app or service centralized, let's say, and I'm able to go there and purchase Tesla stock. That's the use case.
How do I do it?
I could pay for it with Bitcoin or with, I transfer pesos or
doesn't matter,
any payment method.
Yeah.
And then what I get in return are these tokens that are in a wallet, which I could self-custody or I could have a custodian. I have all those options. And these would be, I assume these are like Solana tokens that represent the stock. So in that scenario, I don't see why it matters that it's on the Bitcoin blockchain.
Yeah, right.
It would be where it would matter is if I want to use a decentralized exchange.
Yes.
And then it needs to be a smart contract like Uniswap. You basically need Uniswap that's on the Bitcoin platform. And I don't think Bitcoin script supports that today, like DLCs and what Lava has done with DLCs, which is incredible. It's not powerful enough to do Uniswap. So I also don't even see how Taproot assets or Spark support that, meaning you can create the tokens on either of those platforms, but you still can't create a smart contract on Bitcoin that enables a DEX to trade those. It would be centralized. So, if it's centralized, I don't see why it matters that it's on Bitcoin platform. Except a concern with Solana or you name any altcoin is just like, what's the longevity for that platform? Mm-hmm. I mean, historically, we've seen platforms come and go. And right now, Ethereum and Solana seem like the strongest two. Mm-hmm. And Ethereum certainly has been, strong, relatively strong compared to every other altcoin platform for quite a while now. Solana as well. So it's possible that either or both are here for the long run. Also very possible they die.
They're not.
And they keep getting replaced. And so that's not a reliable system to build stuff on. So to me, the biggest argument for doing it on Bitcoin is that there's way more confidence that Bitcoin's going to be around forever. So you can build on top of that these other platforms.
But I'm still concerned about like those Tesla shares that you want to sell. Let's say somebody in Mexico puts $50,000 worth of pesos into this app. They, on-ramp it. And now they want to buy Tesla shares. And so they buy something called Sol TSLA or whatever. Like, is somebody custodying the actual shares in the U.S. Yes. and selling them exposure? It's almost like a Tether-like thing where they're...
Well, I don't know if they're custodying in the U.S., and that would be something to sort of drill down on. But my assumption from reading this is that it's the same way Tether works or some of the stable coins, in that someone's buying the stock somewhere, whether that's in the U.S. or offshore, holding it in an account, and then, quote-unquote, tokenizing it, representing it on Solana. What I'm saying...
And how do you audit that?
Well, exactly, right? So what I'm saying is, I'm sure there could be some kind of proof of reserves for the Tesla stock or whatever, but I don't know how that would work. But I actually
cryptographic,
yeah. I actually think though.
No, wait a minute, that's crazy.
That was a trick question.
I don't know.
Literally, Tesla stock is issued by the Tesla Corporation.
Yeah, but someone can prove I bought it on whatever my broker is. I don't know, screenshot. I guess that's a terrible example, but
no, it's definitely the Tether model. I mean, you're definitely trusting entity
to trust
to hold
an entity
this.
That's going to custody.
You could have a big four auditor come in and audit it and publish things and get a stamp of approval from a government. That's all possible, which does improve trust, but it's definitely, there's no doubt.
It's not decentralized.
It clearly, well, yeah. And there's a trust model there, just like with stable coins,
right.
which to me doesn't invalidate the idea, but we all have to recognize that it's a very different beast than.
And how do you know if they're not, rehypothecating or lending it out in different ways or fractional reserve? Like
every question you're asking, it's the same you'd ask of Tether.
Yeah, but so I'm saying, why even bother with a DEX or whatever? It's like,
well, and so where I was going with this though originally is if you wanted to go in the more decentralized, I agree. If you're just going to use the centralized, you trust the company or you don't. But it's again, it's sort of like decentralization theater, regulatory arbitrage is what they're going to do. But what I'm saying is you can actually take the ABRA approach, what they tried to do back in the day, and do it now, perhaps with a DLC on top of Lightning. So you actually could build something much more decentralized, which is not I have this fake stable coin or whatever, a stable coin that was issued by a centralized company. But I have a synthetic Tesla position, and that's what ABRA was.
That's the contract for difference.
Yeah. So that you actually could trade decentralized. Now
and I think Uniswap. That's also how it worked on Uniswap.
And you don't have to do it in Uniswap. I know we don't have the script today. Maybe one day we'll get covenants, and that'll happen. But you could. I mean, just in theory, right? Playing around with this, you could do something like, the Nostr order book, where it is sort of a DEX. It's not as perfect, and maybe it's not completely decentralized. You have to have like the reputation piece in there, but I could list like, hey, I'm selling Tesla stock for this much BTC. Here's my signed event. And then, okay, we, you know,
and make the trade. You're, when you're selling your Tesla stock, what are you selling? You're selling the contract for difference?
Yeah. Or whatever the asset is, whether I have the centralized one or the contract for difference. And then I'm saying, here's the amount of BTC I would sell.
I'm maybe an answer to your question or observation, David, which is, why, if you have this trusted issuer that's holding that you're trusting is custodying the actual Tesla stocks, why have a DEX? Well, it could be the case that that centralized entity that's being trusted is heavily regulated by governments and regulators who would say that a certain segment of people can't be customers of that company, whether they're from a certain country or whatever criteria. And so they wouldn't be able to transact on this centralized exchange. But if, with a DEX, anyone can access that. So that would be the value add for a DEX, I think. And so it's not like the DEX is promising you that, you know, you still have to trust the centralized entity, like, is not fractional reserve, not fraudulent, et cetera. You're still trusting that, but you actually gain access to it. And a government can't stop you.
And I would also argue on top of that, this was the argument the Lightning Labs made with Taproot assets early on. I think what Spark is going to do with issuing assets on top of the Spark chain is, you know, if you can get some form of the DEX going there, but even not, even if you need to use the centralized exchange, there's just way more liquidity in Bitcoin, way more people hold Bitcoin. Like if I wanted to use this with Solana, I don't own any Sol. I don't plan to own any Sol. I guess if I had to use V and Kraken, I could transfer in dollars or Bitcoin, convert to Sol.
You're saying for paying fees or paying for the good?
Either one.
Yeah. So it depends. I mean, in the world we live in today, a lot of people buying would just use fiat money, I think. Although if it's, you know, if the market is global, like ex-US, and their local currency, I don't know. I still think they just use their local currency. But
yeah,
but
it seems like the platform should solve that, right? Like the fiat on-ramp.
Imagine though, in the future, if local currencies come on the Bitcoin network too, this is the idea of Bitcoin as the bridge currency. Then all of a sudden, you know, if you have pesos represented on top of the Lightning network, then all of a sudden, my broader point is once it's connected to the internet, you can get a lot more money moving a lot more quickly. When it's trapped, and I would argue pesos, even in the old financial system, that's trapped. Mm-hmm. I have to find a way to move that into whatever the platform is, centralized or otherwise, to convert that to the asset.
Just to, I'm glad we're talking about this because we've wanted to talk about stable coins for a while. So we'll get into that more in a future show. But also like these underlying platforms, and I'll just summarize where I don't have like strong conviction on this stuff. And I'll just summarize where my head's at. A couple of reasons why I can see motivation, and this also extends to like NFTs and JPEGs, God forbid, but like
JPEGs,
whether it be tokens representing gold or real estate or stocks or NFTs or all these things that can be tokenized, whether you love them or hate them, or stable coins. I mean, there's a lot more love. Most people, not everyone in Bitcoin, but most people get the value of stable coins and think it's a reasonable trade-off. And then, you know, less people, but some people see the value in tokenizing stocks and real estate and gold and assets like that. And then NFTs. There's all these different things. And whether you love them or hate them, at least some people like each of them. But yeah, where should they be represented? Should they be on the Bitcoin platform or another platform? So the concern with another platform is like, will that platform survive? Because the way all these other platforms survive is that the underlying token, ETH or SOL or whatever, that it has value, because otherwise the network just stops, right?
Yeah.
So that gets into the question of like, is it money? Is it going to become money? And then it starts to compete with Bitcoin. That's why a lot of Bitcoiners are like, there's going to be one king and it's going to be Bitcoin. All these others are going to zero. And if they go to zero, the network will stop. So are these... And then another dynamic we observe is that new networks pop up all the time. So no one's ever displaced the king, Bitcoin, but Solana is eating Ethereum's lunch right now. Mm-hmm. And there'll be other platforms in the future. So one big question is like, can we even rely on those platforms? But a sub question is, does it even matter? Because we already have, like, any time you're issuing a token, you're trusting some kind of central issuer. So maybe that central issuer just moves to another platform when they need to. Yeah. We've observed this with Tether. Tether's been on Bitcoin and Ethereum and Tron and Sol and now coming back to Bitcoin, right? And even on Bitcoin, they're exploring Taproot assets, RGB, maybe they're exploring Spark, who knows, right? They're more than happy to move around platforms. So does it even matter if the platform is reliable for these tokens? I don't know. So that's one question I have and good for future discussion. Another question we just talked about, which is how much does it matter for the consumer that they can natively spend a cryptocurrency for these assets? And I know that this is I know Rindell for Taproot Wizards, when he left the BitKey team and joined Taproot Wizards, that made me sad. But I was very curious. I have a great respect for him. And I was really curious about why did he make this move? And he was working on this amazing self-custody product. But, my understanding of why he made that move, he loves BitKey and thinks it's important, but he thinks we need to generate more use cases for Bitcoin and reason for people to self-custody. Totally agree with him there. Mm-hmm. He happens to see things like ordinals and NFTs as reasons for people to come to Bitcoin. We can debate that, but he thinks there's tremendous value in pricing things in Bitcoin and people paying Bitcoin and having it on the Bitcoin platform to make sure it's all native so that you don't have to bridge over to Ethereum or Solana and take the risk of all these digital goods being on other platforms and then just being very natural and economically cheaper just to use a Ethereum or Solana token to transact and the threat that is to Bitcoin. That's a debate whether that's how big a threat that is, but that's another interesting discussion. Last thing I'll say, sorry, I'm talking a long time here, but last thing I'll say is a concern I have, which I'd say is I don't have conviction on this concern, but I'm worried about the health of the long-term health of the Bitcoin platform.
The fees.
That's another good topic. Another concern I have is if we bring tokens and stablecoins to Bitcoin, the risk it presents to Bitcoin, and I'll highlight the risk by speaking to a risk that I do have conviction about, which is Circle and USDC on Ethereum. Mm-hmm. I have conviction that that's an enormous threat to Ethereum. Yep. There's so many smart contracts in Ethereum that depend on the value of USDC. It's part of the smart contract. So a lot of capital is locked up into this. So in the future, if there's a contentious fork on Ethereum, fork A and fork B, Circle, the issuer of USDC, and the government can coerce or influence them, has to choose fork A or fork B. You can't, unlike the ETH token where you literally just copy it and duplicate it and you have the value of it on both, you can't duplicate the dollar. So the dollar goes to fork A or B. So if Circle says, we're in favor of fork A, even if that goes against the ethos or philosophy of a lot of people who are into Ethereum, if you've got most of your money wrapped up into that and you lose it all because the smart contract fails, what are people going to do? They're going to follow the fork that the U.S. government wants and Circle wants. That's scary. I mean, I have conviction that that's a real risk. I don't know why it's not talked about more.
Yeah.
I don't want that to happen to Bitcoin.
Right.
And that's I worry about if one specific stablecoin issuer becomes very popular on one specific platform, be it Taproot Assets, RGB, Spark, whatever.
Become a risk.
That it's a repeat of that. And same with tokenization of stocks, if that becomes massive, trillions of dollars of value there, and it will mess with miner and the whole Meeval concept. Yeah. It will mess with miner incentives as well, which could threaten the Bitcoin network and Bitcoin as money.
Yeah.
Yeah. I generally like the idea of encouraging it to be workable off of Bitcoin and use Bitcoin as money to pay for it when you want, but to not actually be otherwise very closely coupled to Bitcoin, mostly for the reasons that you articulate about the risks that it causes you when you have too many people with too much power kind of owning big decisions in the future of Bitcoin.
I think these are all very fair, and this warrants probably its own show, but I would just say I think it also depends on your time horizon. Short term, I agree with that. And I think that's why these networks are great as test nets. In the long run, though, I'll just kind of come back to what I say. If we all think Bitcoin is going to become money, money is one half of every trade. If I have to trade and bridge from the money network to another network, that's going to create more friction. And also, like, how do I know that bridge is actually going to work, right? Whereas if I can have it natively, then I think you're going to have a lot more trading volume in the long run because money is one half of every trade. And like, I know it works in there, but there's risks and we'll see how it plays out.
That's far enough in the future too. We don't know what that future looks like, where these wallets could just do trades for you automatically and get you in and out of whatever you want so that there is much less friction.
And by the way, I still think it's a great idea for someone to build the Lightning Network bridge between all of these other chains. Like, you can actually, anything with HTLCs, you can build a Lightning Network on Solana, and then you can actually start doing some of this high frequency trading between Solana and Bitcoin. That's what I would do as step zero. Another show.
Yeah. Well, we started a little late, so we have a few minutes left. There's no way we're going to cover our third topic. No, so right. Sorry, we're going to rug pull the audience again. Yeah, but we can at least...
In the future.
We can set it up, though. Let's set it up just so maybe people give us feedback on what directions they want us to go.
Yeah.
But I think we wanted to talk about a future world, and maybe this is 30 to 50 years in the future. Think long term. We actually go through hyper Bitcoinization, and like the whole world is on the Bitcoin standard, not just for store of value, but daily, it's everyday money. Everyone's using Bitcoin. What does that world look like? And specifically, I mean, we can look at many angles, but the one I think we were most interested in is in the credit markets. Like, what does debt look like in that world?
Yep.
And whether you're an individual buying a home, whether you're a small business wanting to get started, whether you're a large corporation, there's all the types of different loans, right? Or a government bond, right? Debt market is an enormous market, right?
Yeah.
Lots of different types of debt. So I think it'd be interesting to walk through different types of debt that exists today, how it works. And in the future, if we imagine we're on the Bitcoin standard, do we even need those certain types of debt? Will they exist?
Yeah.
If they do, how do the dynamics change given a completely different money system? Which should be a great topic.
Yeah. I think also largely applying that to like finance in general, like I think how much the financial ecosystem, you know, there's debt, but like how much that even exists in the future. What is the new sort of reference rate of return, which may come from the Lightning Network? Where does equity play in? Like, I know one, I think we're all very excited about living on a Bitcoin standard, but does that have perverse effects on, you know, incentivizing really early stage entrepreneurs experimenting? I think these are all like unknowns.
Max's job is in jeopardy.
That's okay.
I thought he was the last one, the tastemakers.
Well, Mark Andreessen said that the last job standing is venture capital. AI will take over everyone's job except for VCs.
That's a convenient take. Super convenient.
But we'll also talk about the opposite. Maybe VCs' job are in jeopardy.
Nah, the last three jobs left will be a host of the Presidio Bitcoin podcast.
Dude, this is getting replaced this week alone by VO3. Well, they can just get the prompts right.
Our background will be like fire, like the whole world's on fire, and
this
we're
is fine.
The last three talking
this
about.
Is fine. Fine.
All right. We'll wrap the show with that note.
Okay. Sounds good. Till Wednesday.
Till Wednesday.
On Wednesday.
When we see you.
See you on Wednesday from Vegas.
In Vegas. Yeah. All right.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
Adios.